All right, we'll get started to get the maximum benefit of this presentation. My name is Kimberly Lewis. I am a permablogger with FMH. Glad to be here with everybody today. Congratulations for surviving your first full day at Sunstone. We are excited to open up our Friday sessions. Today, we invite you to celebrate what it means to Mormon as a verb, not a noun. Sunstone invites you to show us how you Mormon. If you haven't yet, make sure you grab a Sharpie from the front desk and write on your name badge what kind of Mormon you are or want to be. We are striving to build a community where your authentic Mormon experience is recognized as a legitimate Mormon experience, and you are part of it. Thank you for attending Session 213, titled Black Mormon Women from Baltimore, What They Have Taught Me About Race and Faith. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within that framework of time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. Right? Exactly. Well, allow me the pleasure of introducing Laura Rutter Strickling. She has a PhD in sociocultural linguistics from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Her academic work includes developing a model of linguistic awareness in regards to urban educators and their attitude toward African American English speaking students.
Thank you. So glad you're all here today. This presentation is about race and faith, and the conversion stories of 16 Black Mormon women who are members of my Baltimore congregation. My analysis seeks to overturn the conceptualization that the least of these are somehow deficit, and draws on W.E.B. Du Bois' "We who are dark can see America in a way that white Americans cannot," or more specifically, "We who are dark can see spiritual America in a way that white Mormons cannot." In North America, slavery created a society premised on race, even though slavery was not immediately linked to blackness when the first Africans were brought to Jamestown in 1619. But by the time a generation had passed, European colonists had initiated laws that distinguished white indentured servitude from black indentured servitude, and then slave labor. Whiteness grew to be synonymous with freedom, as well as a safeguard against slave status. Justification for racial hierarchy was upheld by whites seeking economic advantage and a biological essentialist ideology that characterized people of African descent as mentally and morally inferior. By the late 1700s, the practice of enslavement had obscured the ideals upon which our new nation would soon be built. The contradiction between the human bondage that supported the economy and the human right to die free men rather than live as slaves did not result in emancipation, but further dehumanizing of the enslaved. A conceptual shift had been progressing in the new nation, where black people were no longer viewed as enslaved men and women, but instead their social status as slaves had become an inherent embodiment of the traits that were opposite of privilege, rights, and characteristics of the free. Within this schema, black and white were becoming antithetical absolutes, making the black-white racial divide the deepest and most pervasive in all North American color lines. To illustrate, during the 19th century, free citizens became increasingly fearful that the mixing of racial stock would result in white racial degeneracy. Black blood was viewed as a pollutant that needed to be kept in check. So courts attempted to determine degrees of blackness through drops of blood. Racialized behaviors also became important to the differentiation of race. For example, in court, witnesses frequently proved a man's whiteness by reporting on acts of citizenship, such as voting or sitting in a jury. These kinds of legal proceedings further legitimized rights holding as part of what characterized the nature of whiteness. Throughout the decades, courts and other institutional sites of white power reiterated over time and grounded in practice, solidified the racial binary. By the middle of the 20th century, however, this biologically oriented approach to explaining race had begun to lose coherence. Scientific research had proven it impossible to arrive at a set of genetically quantifiable features where humans could be compartmentalized into pure races. Conceptualizations of race in this century have become increasingly viewed as a social construct, where the categorization of human bodies and the formation of racialized behaviors take place within power structures. This perspective holds that a black-white binary is necessary to maintain a white status quo, and that white over color ascendancy still exists in America today because it serves both a psychological as well as an economic purpose. The elevation of whiteness by both people of color as well as whites has served to maintain a kind of implicit racism that has been ingrained in the institutional structure and social fabric of our society. I provide this overview of racialized America to position the purpose of my work. We all inherit the vestiges of our sociocultural racial history from birth, yet women of color have inherited the worst of racism in America over the decades. More than a century ago, they might have been freed legally, but as black nationalist Alexander Crummell states, the act of emancipation had no talismanic influence for black women to reach to alter, or to transform her degraded social life. Within this context, black women in North America might be characterized as the least of these. Yet, black Mormon women have not only converted within a racialized society, but also have had to reconcile their membership in an historically white church that at one time had withdrawn its access to spiritually emancipatory temple ordinances. And so, how do these sisters reconcile this? As a white Latter-day Saint, I found that these black sisters' conversion stories are, for me, windows into a different world, a spiritual universe that resembles my own, but is based upon a strikingly different premise. So let me start with some background on how my research began. When we moved to Baltimore in 2006, the first thing I noticed about our new congregation was the diversity of the female membership. The congregation at that time had about 100 members and consisted of Latino, Nepalese, African-American, Filipino, Korean, and white. There were young mothers with newborn babies and 96-year-old great-great-grandmothers. Some women came to the city to work on doctoral degrees, while others had dropped out of high school at age 15 to take care of children or parents. There were brand-new converts, as well as members who had been raised in the faith with a heritage that traced back to Brigham Young and the Mormon pioneers. On Sundays, there was also a range of conversations among the women characterized by socioeconomic difference. In the foyer, The sisters talk about food stamps and social services, as well as cruises to Mexico and trips to Disney World. Mothers anguished over visiting a son in jail on the one hand and sending a daughter to Europe by herself on the other. From an academic point of view, I was drawn to this linguistically rich congregation and wondered in what ways the social and linguistic differences of the membership impacted our worship and relationships. What immediately caught my attention were the prayers offered by the African American women in our church meetings. They spoke informally and prayed about personal matters, even though they were praying in behalf of the group. For example, "Father, I want to thank you for all you've done for our sisters and brothers, and thanks for the love that you've given my dad who has cancer." I felt as if they had invited me into their lives when I heard their prayers, and that they had perhaps made themselves vulnerable to the listeners for that moment. I also noticed certain phrases that were common at the beginning of their prayers. "Thank you, Heavenly Father, for waking us up this morning in our right mind." Then I didn't know that these women were opening their prayers in their tradition of black preachers, praising God for another morning where our sleeping couch is not our cooling board and our cover is not our winding sheet. In other words, we did not find ourselves dead today, but rather clothed in our right mind. And some of the African-American women would approach the pulpit with a version of first giving honor to God, who is the head of my life, and to Jesus Christ and the Holy Ghost and Bishop Lewis and the elders who are sitting behind me, before bowing their heads to pray. This was a cultural and linguistic worship aesthetic that I was not familiar with. These were not the prayer phrases I had heard growing up or in any of the congregations I had attended as an adult. My academic inquiry became integrated with my search for spiritual understanding and sisterhood. Culturally and racially, I was an outsider in the lives of these African American women, but as sisters in the gospel, I shared conversion with them. So I would start with that intersection where our lives met. Most of these women were born and raised in Baltimore and were the first Mormon converts in their family. They all faithfully attended church and accepted callings, but all except two had not served in church leadership positions, and I had rarely heard them speak in Sunday school or Relief Society discussions. I asked a few of them if I could record their conversion stories. I soon found that these sisters had profoundly inspiring stories to tell. Embedded in their conversions were miracles and heavenly visitations, but also heartbreaking events incited by inner city violence that produced a kind of despair that, as a white person from rural Oregon, I had not experienced. I felt that these black sisters possessed a spiritual trust that I could not be acquainted with. And I wanted to understand the faith that appeared to be inseparably woven into their racialized, gendered life experiences that were so different from mine. This conversion story project became a 10-year endeavor that resulted in recorded interviews with sisters ranging in age from 46 to 94 and over 400 pages of transcription. So several themes emerged from these sisters' conversion stories. Motherhood was an integral part of their faith, and the act of raising children and losing children in Baltimore is associated with their conversion. The women see overwhelming child-rearing conditions or crises relating to the deaths of their children as junctures of despair that left them vulnerable or bitter, but also open to conversion and spirituality. All the women I interviewed have been single mothers at one time in their lives. Four had their first child by the age of 18. And collectively, these 16 women have raised 85 children. Six women dropped out of high school at an early age to take care of a sick parent or child. One out of that six went back later and finished high school. And four women have attended college. One has graduated with an associate's degree. Almost all the women tell their conversion stories against the backdrop of raising children alone as teenage or young adult mothers struggling well below the poverty line, or fear that their children would wind up on drugs, in jail, or injured in street violence. In Baltimore, we've had 31 homicides in the last 30 days. Three of those were within blocks of our church, and one of those was the brother of a sister I visit teach. Two years ago, in 2015, 344 killings resulted in the highest per capita homicide rate in Baltimore City history. While we had a drop last year with only 319 homicides, this year we're back up with an increase of 46 so far in June. Eunice talks about how hard it was to raise her children when drugs started taking over the neighborhood. It was just as dangerous in her high-rise apartments as it was on the streets.
Things were great for a period of time, but you know, as the years change and generations change, things got crazy, especially when the drug scene hit in the 80s. So that's the bad part, the drug scenes. And it got to the point you didn't know whether you should go out or whether you should come back home because things were so bad.
Clara grew up with an alcoholic mother, an abusive alcoholic husband who took all of her savings and left her alone to raise her children. She told me that she used to take her kids to the suburbs to see the grass and flowers because the city is full of addictions, she said. So here's what she says about that.
It is a disease, and it disrupts the whole family. Mm-hmm. And my gosh, you see it all through the city. It's there. Mm-hmm. And the behaviors, how it does affect, it affects the whole family.
Georgia was on her way to church when she missed the last step and hit her head. After going to the doctor, she found that her retinas had detached. But the night before eye surgery, she had two heart attacks. Then, while she was recovering in the hospital from that, Child Protective Services took away her granddaughter, who was living with her. In this audio, Georgia explains her reaction to adversity.
You know, God saved my eyesight. He saved my life. And still, in the process, made me strong, that I still was able to get around and recover to still take care of my daughter, take care of my family. I mean, that's nothing but you had to have faith like that. And you to keep going strong and keep going in the battle. Now, let me tell you, wasn't no song and dance. I came home, I cried, I threw my Bible. I said, God, why me? Me and God basically had it out. Just like a parent standing, waiting till you're done. God, wait till I'm done. Then I got up, realized I wasn't going to get my way because it was going to be Mama's way or God's way. And then I did what I was supposed to do.
Later, in reference to the increased violence in 2015, Georgia told me this. She said, I am so blessed that me or my children have never seen a shooting, that we've never had to see someone killed. I thank the Lord for that. I didn't understand the magnitude of this praise to God until I started hearing other sisters' stories. One sister told me this. The first time I saw a dead person was when I was walking home from school in third grade. There was this teenage boy who'd been shot in the head, and he was laying there in a pool of blood. His mother was wailing by his side, I mean screaming like an animal, and I just stood there and stared. Nobody tried to keep me away. Nobody cared about that. The police were writing something on notepads. After that, I saw a dead person about 3 or 4 times a year. Here, Vanessa talks about leaving a husband who beat her and threatened her by holding a gun to her head. She describes her situation as, it was my last dollar. I didn't have heat, electricity, or food for my two boys. I didn't know how I was going to get by, but I trusted God so much, I knew he would make a way. Here's an excerpt from that.
I had left my husband because he was abusive, very physically abusive, worldly abusive. He was a whoremonger. That's what the Bible states. And I couldn't take anymore after 11 and a half years. I didn't know what else to do. And I didn't have money to go and buy soap powder or to get some little snackies for my kids. And I was upset. I just said, I just had it. I said, okay, this is it.
Sarah has raised three generations of children and is still raising her great-granddaughter. She had her first child at age 16 in the same year her mother died in childbirth, so she took on her newborn baby sister and two younger siblings as her own. In this audio clip, you'll hear Sarah explain how close she was to her mother.
My mother would say, girl, wake up, we gotta wake up, you know. I'd sit there and lay on her lap or lay on her shoulder. Because I just was so close to my mother, and I want to be wherever she was at. And when she passed, I had a nervous breakdown.
Sarah describes her loss and the weight of her new responsibility to mother four children as an event that left her with a sickness that the doctors could not cure. After baptism, she told me that she was no longer sick. Here's how she explains the first day she ever attended church.
Went to church with her that Sunday, and, you know, I'd been through so much myself, and going that Sunday, it was just like, I don't know, just stepping out one place into another one. Mm-hmm. I was so lovable, everybody, you know, just hugged me. They act like they know me for years. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, I never had this much love in my life.
Another theme connected to the faith and conversion of these women is the death of their children. Three women lost children because they were shot and killed in the city. Nine women have had close family members who were killed by shooting or other acts of violence. Here, Harriet's story illustrates how a dangerous neighborhood penetrated her home when her son brought a gun home. You will hear her explain how her baptism helped her forgive her teenage son for shooting her younger son.
James, my oldest son, had a gun and brought it in the house, and I didn't know he had it, and was showing it to his brother, and it went off. Mm-hmm. And he come running in the room. Mama, I shot Lonzo. I said, you what? He started bleeding worse. They had put a dialysis machine on him to try to stop the bleed. That didn't do no good. He bled to death. And after that, I turned around and I blamed his brother for it. I said, if you didn't put that gun in here, he wouldn't be in here. And I was evil and mean, just against him and everything. I wouldn't even let him in the house, nowhere around me. I ain't want nowhere around me. Then I got baptized. About 2 weeks later, I started feeling different. So when he did come to the door, he said, Ma, you all right? I looked at him and said, yeah, I'm all right. He said, do you still play? And I said, no, I forgive you.
Another persistent theme in these women's conversion stories was a feeling of abandonment and the need to reunite with mothers who had died. Performing temple ordinances for their mothers was key to their healing process. 11 women lost mothers when they were children, and 7 of those women talk about reuniting with their mothers through proxy baptisms performed in the Washington, D.C. temple. As these women progressed closer to the time when they would enter the temple to perform baptisms, they reported having impressions, dreams, and unexpected visitations from deceased mothers. The women talked about feeling the presence of their mothers, and for some, actually seeing them. They also talked about pleasing their mothers who had died. When Eunice was baptized in the temple for her deceased mother, she told me this. When I came up out of the water, it was like I saw a face smiling at me. But I never told people that. I wouldn't tell them because they'd say, she's lost her mind. But it was a good feeling. Everything fell into place, and I was relieved and pleased, and I'm pretty sure my mother was pleased also. This is Sarah, who we heard a few minutes ago, and her sister Rachel, who she raised from birth. Here they explain that baptism for the dead was the church doctrine that prompted their conversion. They immediately began preparing for the temple because Rachel wanted to be baptized for her mother who had died giving birth to her. They are both speaking here.
Because, you know, like I said, I've been to many churches, and you never hear nobody say, or the preacher will say, you know, you can baptize for the dead. He never mentioned that.
It was amazing to us.
When they performed the proxy baptism, Sarah describes the event as, "My mother was right there because it was her own baby baptizing her." In the temple, Harriet was baptized in behalf of her mother, grandmother, and sister. A male friend was baptized for her son who had been shot. She said this about her experience.
When I first went to the temple, it felt like I was in heaven. It was so peaceful and quiet. It was like I seen angels floating over me and everything, and I couldn't believe it. And after I got in the water, I still felt like I was floating in heaven. And did the baptism for them. And it looked like I could see them telling me, thank you.
Shira tells about a reoccurring dream that she had after her mother died. But after baptism in the temple, the nature of the dream changed.
My mom wasn't a member of the church. After she died, I would dream about her all the time. But the thing about it, I would never see her face. I could never see her face. And every time I would dream about her, she was always sick, in the wheelchair or in the bed sick. And this was sad for me, and I was grieving. So then, when I finally got to do the work for her, this is the honest truth. As I did the work for my mother, I dreamed about my mother, and she wasn't sick anymore. I could see her face, and she wasn't in a wheelchair, and me and her was being together. You know, we was doing things together.
So these audios give us a sense of these black sisters' lives and their faith. But how did they reconcile church history? How did they reconcile that at one time emancipatory temple ordinances had been withheld from people of African descent? I found two kinds of responses to this question. The first one was, it didn't matter. Before Ruth was baptized, like Joseph Smith, she had a vision. She said, "I really, really wanted to know the truth. So I got down on my knees, and it was the first time in my life I had ever prayed like this. With all the faith I had, I prayed for 2 weeks. Then one night, I went to sleep and received a vision of Jesus Christ and his Father." During our interview, I asked Ruth what she thought of the claim that ours is a white church in reference to the priesthood ban, and she told me this.
You know, it didn't matter to me what anyone says, because I had a testimony that witnessed from the Spirit. So nothing could ever change that, you know.
Opal's response was similar, but for different reasons. She accepted the church for what it meant to her in the here and now, and the past didn't matter. A persistent critique of people who live in poverty is that they lack self-control. So instead of being able to withhold short-term satisfaction for a future reward, they tend to make nearsighted choices that keep them in a vicious cycle of poverty. For example, I know of a church sister who lived with an assortment of family members on the same side of town as Opal, and who was receiving church and government welfare assistance. One day, the family was bequeathed a gift of a couple hundred dollars from an inheritance. So instead of putting the money aside for next week's gas and electric expenses, they decided to celebrate and spent the money in one fell swoop, feasting on crab. This decision, of course, was frowned upon by church leadership, who allocated welfare assistance, a disapproval based on assumptions of agency and character. But missing from the discussion was an inquiry into what a life of poverty might engender. Waiting for future compensation requires trust, and those who have lived with instability for generations have learned that the future does not pay off. Poverty necessitates people to think short term and to live in the permanent here and now. It was the same frame of mind that became fertile ground for Opal's faith. She did not need an explanation of why at one time the church had practiced polygamy or had withheld priesthood ordinances from black people. The church, as it is in the present, was enough for her. This is an audio of Opal, and here Opal's talking with her daughter. They had a discussion, so you hear her talk about her daughter here.
daughter said, why are you doing the Mormon church? And you know that they have more than one wives. And you said, yeah, the Mormon, they got more than one. They got five and six wives and everything. So when finally got to know the church, I said, well, they don't have no all the many wives. They was talking about that. It was like way back, you know, way back then. They changed everything. But Dora said it was all white church. The girls, now I'm an all white church. We got black, white, Hispanic, Chinese, Japanese, Philippine, African.
Another way these sisters reconciled the withdrawal of priesthood and temple ordinances was with this explanation. They said, Mormons were following the prophet more than Christ. Letha was baptized in 1976 and was the only sister I interviewed that became a member before the priesthood ban was lifted. When I asked her to tell her thoughts about why black people were denied access to temple ordinances, she told me this.
Because most of those Mormons came from the South, and they had slaves. As they moved along to Utah, they would have the slaves prepare places.
Letha to explain more, and I said, so you're saying a little racism slipped in? And she said, of course, because the whites were so tied up with what was happening at the time. It happens today too, but in subtle ways. Lots of people, even at church, don't like blacks, but that's the way life is. You have to go along with the program, try your best, and ask forgiveness. We're not going to see peace until Jesus Christ comes. Then Letha said, well, all churches have their problems of people not believing in their teachings. Now, I see this as a merciful explanation to one who had experienced racism in the church. It was also a dialectical conversation Letha was having with herself. On the one hand, racism was personal and had been an integral part of her life. Yet on the other, she did not harbor resentment or seek retribution. Letha was troubled by the unchristian racist behavior of her fellow Mormons who had espoused spiritual truth, yet she acknowledges that's the way life is. She had reconciled racism in the church and the priesthood ban by conceptualizing members and doctrine as separate entities existing within a church organization. The doctrine of Christ stood supreme, immovable, and available to all. But the church organization, one that consisted of prophets, leaders and members, revelation and practices, evolved with the tide of social change, like a living organism. In the end, Letha had resolved, you do what you gotta do as a Christian. If you don't know, you don't judge. From these stories, I have drawn the following conclusions. The first comes from my friend and colleague Intia, who is not a Latter-day Saint and whose expertise lies in hip-hop and black politics. I explained to her my interest in publishing the conversion stories of the African-American women in my congregation, and she said this about my work. You mean there are black Latter-day Saints? Then the thing I want to know is why Mormon? How does a black person get to the Mormon church? Mormons seem to be the farthest thing away from the black experience. The black diaspora does not take me to Utah. These Black Mormon women address Intia's question and have helped to broaden our collective Latter-day Saint identity. Their conversion, like mine, has risen from racialized, gendered spiritual experiences. And while the value of their experiences has perhaps been overlooked, their stories have provided me with insight into the quality of spirit necessary for faith to flourish, which I see as a complete surrendering without guile or pretense, a kind of vulnerable rawness of the soul that leaves us exposed and longing to be filled. I hear this quality of faith in my friend Lydia, who, after she was baptized, continues to struggle with drug addiction, accepting the death of her mother and daughter, and suicidal depression, but who also told me that she wakes up every morning with this prayer.
Oh, Lord, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord, for this day. I get to see another day. I don't know what this day is going to bring, but I'm willing to accept anything. You know, I'm willing to accept anything.
So instead of categorizing others as the least of these, whether we are stereotyping by race, gender, social capital, level of education, or something else, I have learned to be a student. I think Lorraine Hansberry describes this best. You may know that she was the first Black woman to write a Broadway play, and it was entitled A Raisin in the Sun. She also wrote, "To be young, gifted, and Black." At that time, Hansberry was speaking to Black artists. But in my view, she is also describing these Black women from Baltimore. Here's what she said. Do you want to know about despair? Listen to those who have known little else if you wish to know the resiliency of this thing. Life? Ask those who have tasted of it in pieces rationed out by enemies. Love? Ask the troubadours who have loved when all reason pointed to the uselessness and foolhardiness of love. Out of the depths of pain, we have thought to be our sole heritage in this world. Oh, we know how to love. And perhaps we shall be the teachers when it is done. So, thank you. It is open. I'd love to hear your thoughts, impressions, and questions. The drawback is you have to come up here and use the microphone because this session is being recorded. Or maybe, yeah, is it the microphone? You can pull it out and hold it. So don't let that inhibit you. Or maybe we can bring it around to them. Just your impressions. Your thought, it doesn't have to be, just what comes to your mind. Or you can yell it out. Yes, come.
Yeah. All right, I have kind of, with your conclusion, it seemed very poetic, but I was like trying to follow. There's obviously a lot of factors that would lead Black women to join the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. I was wondering very specifically, like, what are some of the common factors you saw within these 16 women, because it seemed very poetic, but I wasn't quite following the specifics of why you think this would be common.
Wait, don't go yet. So you're asking what were the factors of their conversion?
What was their factors? Yeah, in converting and continuing onward within the LDS Church specifically. That, like, why would they be interested specifically in the LDS Church? When there are other options for other religions, for example?
In the work I've done, there were, which is soon to be a book, by the way, there is, there are themes, and then there are some, like, for example, authenticity. They didn't find authenticity in their religious experience. Like, you can't serve God and drink with the devil. They've told me that, you know, you can't hold fire in one hand and water in the other, and that's what they were experiencing throughout their lives. I thought perhaps you could get a sense of why they were converted with a lot of their conversion stories here. Some had to do with I think this sense of love that they have not felt before in a kind of a different way than they felt in their life. They've received, you know, it's kind of surprising, but many of them had just saw on TV the Free Book of Mormon and wanted something free, and so so they called in, and then when the missionaries came to their door, they go, whoa, wait a minute, I didn't know people were going to come with this. And then, you know, this one sister talks about how she was looking through the peephole, and she said, I don't think I can answer the door. And then she got this feeling, answer the door. So she answers the door and then listens to the missionaries. And then there's quite a few that have been converted because of the, you know, the media, you know, the Free Book of Mormon thing. But I have to say that they have all had their own spiritual experiences that have converted them. They have felt in their, and they're describing it in their own way. So from an academic view or from like pulling across themes, I can tell you that, but I was hoping that I portrayed that some of that feeling there that of why they converted, please.
Yeah. Thank you so much, by the way. This is such important work, so I really thank you for this presentation. As you were just responding to that question and also through your presentation, yesterday a panel I was on, the research I did for my portion, I looked at two 19th century Mormon women. And it was so interesting to me that as you were talking, two themes came out in those women. One of them was Jane James, so she was a very, you know, one of the few black women. The other one was one of my ancestors who was a white woman. But for both of them, key to their involvement in Mormonism was a deep spiritual conversion that was very real and vital to them. And the other thing, their children, that came out in their stories, raising and losing children, and the mothering aspects and the way that was connected to their experiences. So I thought that was so interesting that two of the themes that came out in your stories came out in this work I did in 19th century women. But that deep spirituality and the way it connected with their mothers, their mothering, their children, and the losses that they went through and how their faith helped them in that.
Thank you. I have done presentations before only on the mothering aspect. So, yeah, come please, make do.
I had a nephew that went on a mission to South Carolina, and he felt like the African Americans that he taught were hungry and just absorbed the church. But when they went to church, they were not accepted by the white congregation. And that's been maybe 15 years ago, and I'm wondering if that's changed.
Well, before you hang up the microphone, can you give us some idea of in what ways they felt they weren't accepted?
he said that they would go to church and nobody would sit by them, mm-hmm. and wouldn't talk to them, and they soon, you know, would not come anymore. And so they just felt ostracized by the white congregation, which was sad.
So South Carolina is different from Baltimore. Do you know where, actually, was it in a metropolitan, it was in a rural area?
Well, he went around, so I don't know.
So in a variety of areas, maybe. So, I mean, it is a different state. It is farther south. it was 15 years ago. I can't really speak to South Carolina is what I'm saying. But these sisters, my sister friends, have mentioned they have felt racist kinds of behaviors. Excuse me. And I've asked them before how they've dealt with it. I don't know. It's all very individual. Some would just tell me that they've actually went and talked to that person. Excuse me. Others have said that they just ignore it. And I've had some that have said, you know, race isn't an issue with me, but when I feel a negativity come out,
then that bothers me. So race is a volatile issue among all races, but especially blacks and whites. And there's many layers of things that if we haven't individually reflected upon the forces at play, what we're inherited with, I don't know if we can get to the bottom and have this real kind of face-to-face discussion. So instead of that, like I said, sisters have just said, I'm not going to sit by that sister. In fact, I just was transcribing yesterday, or writing part of my chapter yesterday, that one sister said yes, that she had she wouldn't be specific. She was very beaten around the bush with me. She said that one sister, it had to do with color, but had approached her and said something that hurt her feelings. And so she said, but my mother always told me, there's going to be people like that, but don't you be like that. You pray for them to come to the right mind, their right mind. And so she did. She did what her mother said. This was like a 50-year-old woman, did what her mother said and talked to that woman, but she said she never got close to her. She just would not sit by her anymore. So there's just strategies and mechanisms that take place. They're requiring us that you talk through that.
I missed most of your presentation. I came in late, and I'm so sorry. But I guess my question is, these women that see the lack of racial diversity in the church in Baltimore, in their particular wards, maybe it's different. Maybe they feel more like they're part of the majority in that area. But how did they deal with the lack of racial diversity in the church? Maybe they haven't been out, you know, into different congregations, but just looking like at the leadership, that sort of thing. Did you get any sense for what they make of that?
You did miss the part that told about how our ward was full of diversity, not just racial diversity, but all kinds of diversity. And your question had to do with the leadership, right? Well, first let me tell you that most of these women, I would say a good amount of the women, haven't been even on the other side of Baltimore much. They're born, raise their children, and die within blocks sometimes. I mean, they might take the bus here or there, but sometimes not.
I taught in Baltimore, and my students had a similar experience. Like, many of them had not, you know, been to Washington, D.C. and tell me.
Right. Where in Baltimore did you teach?
It's Western High School. It's off of Falls River.
Yep, I know that. I worked in a postdoc position for 2 years in inner city Baltimore on turnaround schools, so I was visiting schools. I have not heard the issue of church leadership being not diverse is something I hear from progressive whites. I don't hear that. That's not an issue with them. That, you know, it's like there's two separate worlds here, and I was hoping I showed you that. That you got all this discussion going on over here. I was speaking to Kimberly Lewis earlier about this, you know, the issue of like wearing pants to church or that kind of thing. It's just like totally so out of our experience that, I mean, this is not our, you know, we just want them to come to church, you know, and that's what it is, you know. And so I just don't hear that. From my experience, I can't speak to that. So it's a good question. I don't know. Are we supposed to end? I don't know.
I just wanted to continue with what you just said.
Right.
We have a retreat in Colorado, Rocky Mountain Retreat, and a couple of years ago, Misha McGriggs came, and we had a good discussion about the difference between white Mormon feminism and black Mormon or people of color feminism, and that they are trying to get together and understand each other better because it's really on different pages. And so it's a learning process, you know. We were so glad that she came and talked to us about that because it was out of my, you know, experience. I live in near Boulder, Colorado, and I think there are maybe two black people in our stake, you know. So it's, and that's what I'm thinking, the people who aren't friendly and don't go out of their comfort zone to talk to people that are different from they are, they're, I think they're just shy, don't know what to say, don't know how to start up a conversation, and they don't feel adequate, you know, to talk to somebody. But, you know, you have to step out of that because it's just going to be a cycle. You know, the more the white people get out of that and embrace the people of color, then the more they'll feel comfortable to come, because there'll be a more, you know, there'll be more more people like them there that they, you know, it's like a, you know, the ball rolling.
Thank you.
It has to start.
And while this gentleman's coming up, let me just say that black feminism wouldn't exist. I mean, there's a socioeconomic difference here that we're talking about, and black feminism isn't wouldn't be something these sisters would associate with.
Just to kind of continue off of that, I think that there's a certain amount of privilege that comes with being, you know, a white person in the church. And I say this as someone who is only half white myself. But, I mean, I have been tremendously lucky in my Mormon experiences that I've been in wards that have been relatively progressive and relatively liberal and relatively open. And that's allowed me space to then critique things like, why is there, like, zero color representation at the top? But when you're in a situation where you're just glad that you found a place that feels comfortable to you at all, the stuff that happens outside of that, even if it's the same organization, you're so worried about the local because that's now your home, that the stuff that happens beyond that is like out there. Until it filters in, you don't even worry about it.
Right.
You know,
right.
So.
Thanks. I also have to say, too, that our bishop was black. I mean, we have Bishop Rick always has someone of color, or, you know, we have, it's not only white leadership in our local side. I think, yeah.
And I would like to thank you so much for this presentation. I think it's so good to meet real people and hear their stories and not impose our prejudices in terms of how we think their lives must be. The thing that I was so impressed with about all of these women is their spirituality and their embracing of their real lives, their actual lives. And as someone who has been writing about feminism for a long time, one thing that I think the white feminist movement has missed is embracing the role of motherhood. And so I was so happy to see how all of these women, part of their identity and their strength was their love for their children and their service to their children, raising not only their own children, but others, as I could tell from what you said, generations.
There's a network.
And stepping in. And I just had such a strong sense of the authenticity of the lives of these women. They are living from their own knowledge and experience, and then they are embracing things that they find that are good. And I loved the one woman who said the church was following the prophet more than Christ. And to me, that is one of the main problems that our church experiences. If we would look more to Christ for direction, we would be able to face many of the problems. So thank you so much. I loved hearing about these women.
Thank you. You're welcome. Wrapping up. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your attention and great discussion afterwards.